Our goal today is to consider science, religion, and ethics, and how they relate to each other. In order to do that, we first need to get a clear idea of what it is that each of these parts of human life refer to. Science refers to the quest for knowledge. And during at least the last 200 years, it has been taken to refer to that knowledge acquired by the use of the experimental method. That method consists of, one, formulating some hypothesis or theory, two, deducing what kinds of observations would verify or falsify that hypothesis or theory, and three, conducting experiments in the space-time world to get relevant evidence on whether the hypothesis might be true or whether it's probably false. An important part of this procedure is that these experiments have to be repeatable, with the same results continuing to be observed. That's why scientists cannot investigate unique occurrences. They have to be able to repeat the experiments and get the same results. Religion, traditionally, has referred to beliefs and practices related to gods or other supernatural forces, often including beliefs about continuing existence after death. Note that I said traditionally, since I want to allow for the possibility of a different notion of religion to be developed in this post-Enlightenment world. Following the views of Unitarian Universalist theologian Henry Nelson Wieman, W-I-E-M-A-N, an alternative way of defining religion is, quote, living in accord with that to which one is ultimately committed. Let me read that again. Living in accord with that to which one is ultimately committed. Two of Wieman's books about religion are Man's Ultimate Commitment and The Source of Human Good. Thanks to our former member John Breuer, both these books are available in our church library, and I commend them to you. Ethics refers to a set of ideas about what should be done. That is, about what is good and bad, or right and wrong. The term ethics is sometimes restricted to ideas about what an individual person should do or should not do. But in this talk, I want to use the term more broadly to include all ideas about what should or should not be done, including what a group or society should or should not do. In fact, if one focuses on this issue of what a society should or should not do, rather than the more individualistic ethics, one is engaged in another discipline called social philosophy. But I want to include that in our discussion of ethics. The critical thing for our present discussion is that ethics focuses on values rather than facts. The concern of ethics is what should be, not what is. That is what makes ethics a branch of philosophy rather than part of science. When ordinary people think of science, they often think in terms of the conclusions now generally accepted by those doing the experimental work of science, rather than thinking about the method that has been and is being used to arrive at those conclusions. One difficulty that then arises is a failure to recognize that the conclusions of science can change as more experiments are conducted and more evidence is accumulated. For example, in the discipline of physics, The accepted belief at the end of the 20th century, the year 1900, was that matter cannot be converted to energy. That idea was questioned by Einstein in 1905. He wrote his books to demonstrate this. And the atomic bombs developed 40 years later proved that he was correct, that matter can be converted to energy, and lots of it. That's what happens with an atomic bomb. Matter is converted to energy. Think for a moment about the implications of what I just said. If you were a student taking a true-false physics test in 1900, and the statement to be evaluated was, matter cannot be changed to energy, the correct answer would be true. That's exactly what scientists believed at that time. 10 years later, 1910, that answer would be debatable. And 50 years later, it would be regarded as definitely false. What is really true doesn't change, but what we humans regard as true can change, especially in this scientific age. All of the conclusions of science are tentative. All people, even the best informed ones, are fallible. And in fact, that might be said to be one of the main ideas of science, fallibilism, that what we now believe could be mistaken. Nevertheless, there are some conclusions backed by much scientific experimentation that do in fact come to be generally regarded as true. And when they contradict the statements inscribed in a written text regarded by a religious group as scripture, as truth revealed to God by God to religious spokespersons, a real conflict of ideas can occur. One obvious example is in the area of astronomy, where biblical writers adopted the viewpoint of their time, roughly between 200 before the Common Era and 200 after the Common Era. Most of the Bible was written during that 400-year period. Namely, that the sun goes round the earth. That was the accepted idea of the day. And they even went on and noted that there could be daylight and darkness independent of the sun. So that they had this crazy idea that the sun was created on the fourth day. So how could you have days and nights before there's a sun? Copernicus and Galileo used the method of science to show rather conclusively that those older views, still being promoted by the church in the 16th and 17th centuries, were false. An even more important source of conflict between the ideas advanced in the Bible and the conclusions reached by scientists is Darwin's experimentally based theory of biological evolution by chance variation and natural selection. It's important for people to know the idea of evolution was much older than Darwin. Anaxagoras, Greek philosopher in the 4th century BC, had come up with the idea. He based his argument on the fact that if children were born as human beings, they wouldn't be able to take care of themselves. There had to be a gradual evolution of life. But Darwin came up with experimental evidence, not only that evolution had occurred, but that it had occurred in a certain way, chance variation and natural selection. This also included the idea that the earth is much older than one would think on the basis of statements in the Bible. Now, in this day, new evidence from the study of DNA is giving even more support to the theory of biological evolution as the way that new species come into being, as opposed to the idea of independent creation of each species by God as described in the Bible. And that's why we're having these huge intellectual debates, because of the new way, the new evidence from DNA to further support Darwin's ideas. The great significance of the theory of evolution, and the reason that all of the traditional religions attack it so vehemently, is that it shows that humans differ from other animals only in degree, not in kind. That was the earlier belief, that human beings are a different kind of being. It then becomes more difficult for these traditional religions to claim that humans have an immortal, immaterial soul, which other animals do not. If elephants don't have souls, if chimpanzees don't have souls, and human beings are just evolved, how can human beings have souls? How can they be so different from these other animals? This in turn raises the question, an important question for everyone. Why is it okay to kill animals, but not humans? And of course, that's exactly why many more people are becoming vegetarians. So far, the traditional religions are still fighting against the idea of evolution, rather than trying to develop a good answer to this important question about the moral difference between killing other animals and killing people. Nevertheless, the main thing that religion should learn from science is not just adopting its tentative conclusions at this moment, but the important fact that our human ideas about what is true and good are fallible and are always subject to change as we have new experiences and consider new possibilities. This situation means that religion should drop its dogmatism and accept the view that it is best to adopt conclusions tentatively and openly affirm the possible desirability of adopting new views. Religion has generally been conceived as involving some kind of firm commitment. Unfortunately, most traditional religions, and especially Christianity, have firmly committed themselves to believing certain ideas about what is true and what has really happened. But they should learn from science that one's commitment should be to a good procedure or method for discovering what is true and what is good, rather than committing themselves to some particular dogma about what is true and what is good, some ideas which were sanctified at some particular time by a particular group of people. This particular point is very important in my own personal life, because at one time I was studying to become a Lutheran minister. I decided not to continue with that. And one of the important ideas that came to me, why should I be committed to believing that Jesus was resurrected or that Jesus wasn't resurrected? There's going to be new evidence coming up all the time. How can I commit my life to believing some historical fact did or didn't occur? It's not the right kind of thing to commit yourself to. You have to commit yourself to a way of gaining new knowledge. But what is that right procedure or method to which religion should commit itself? With regard to discovering what is true, a commitment to the scientific method is appropriate but not sufficient. Religion must also be concerned about ethics, about what is good, about what should be done. And in this area, scientific method is not going to be enough. We may be able to conduct experiments to discover what the facts are, but experimentation cannot show us how things ought to be. For example, if you repeatedly cheat and never get caught, does that experimental result show that it was good to cheat? That isn't how we decide ethical issues. goodness involves something more than success in reaching some end. Science can help us on what is the best means to this end, but science is not helpful in terms of what are the good ends and what are not good ends. Besides, one can continue to ask this question, what are the good ends? What should we be aiming for? Science can't answer that kind of question. Therefore, we need something beyond science. There are even some metaphysical issues where scientific method is not going to be able to decide the answer. Metaphysical questions are questions that are true or false, but have to do with very general issues. For example, the ultimate shape of the universe. This is still a matter for debate, and we're never going to be able to conduct an experiment to find the answer. We're going to be able to conduct experiments that may be relevant to helping us think it through, but we're not going to be able to do an experiment to determine what is the shape of the universe. Another interesting one is that we cannot conduct experiments to find out whether some events happen by chance, that is, haphazardly, or whether all events happen because they are determined to occur by virtue of some cause or some reason. Because in the face of unsuccessful predictions, the determinist says, well, we just don't know enough yet. Whereas the indeterminist says, well, now that shows that not everything is determined because you can't predict everything. Failure in this area is not going to show us which metaphysical view is correct. There is no way to conduct an experiment to decide these metaphysical issues. Consequently, in the areas of ethics and metaphysics, we need a commitment to some method or approach besides just the scientific method. What is it? What method will work best when it's not possible to perform an experiment to get the evidence? Well, when dealing with an issue of what should be done in a particular situation, one possible method is to consult one's conscience. What seems right to me? What seems to me the right thing to do in this situation? The difficulty with that method is that one's answer is likely to be based on very limited personal experience and might be influenced by particular factors that might be different on some other occasion. It would be better to also take into account what other people think should be done in this situation, especially if they have a lot of experience to rely on. This kind of knowledge we can acquire by reading and by listening to others. But it would be even better if we could engage in conversation with others about the issue, asking questions and bringing various issues up for consideration. And the more diverse the experience of those others involved in the discussion, and the more open to various viewpoints the conversation is, the better the decision about what should be done is likely to be. This method could be described as the philosophical or dialectical method, because it is the method of free and open discussion of various viewpoints used by philosophers, where all are free to challenge the views advanced by others and to advance arguments to support their differing views. So philosophy may provide for us kind of a model of how to proceed in these areas. This method I'm talking about could also be described as the democratic method, because it encourages all parties to participate in the discussion as equals, listening to what others say, but also contributing their own insights and suggestions. Everyone's opinions are welcome, but also subject to attempted refutation by others. A crucial aspect of this method, of this democratic method, is respect for everyone and no animosity just because another person disagrees and argues for an opposing conclusion. One of the experiences I had when I was teaching, I would team teach with people, with other faculty members who didn't always agree with me on some points, and students could not believe that we were good friends. I mean, their view was, you know, if you're so opposed to each other, how can you be friends? That was a viewpoint that's got to be changed. We've got to have the openness to people who disagree with us and don't say, you are an enemy because you disagree with me. That's not appropriate. Henry Nelson Wyman, the Unitarian Universalist theologian I mentioned earlier, calls this kind of open discussion the process of creative interchange. And he argues that it is the kind of process or method to which we should be committed when dealing with those ethical and metaphysical questions not amenable to scientific investigation. In other words, when the issue being considered is the kind that cannot be answered by conducting an experiment, then the method to which we should be committed is the process of creative interchange. Also, when we examine the history of philosophy, and even the history of science, and the history of democratic government, we see that what they have in common is their use of this process that Wyman calls creative interchange. In fact, when we examine the history of science, we see that even the scientific method is just a special case of this particular kind of back and forth argumentation and trying to give good reasons to support one's conclusions. This is the process of creative interchange. Human experience has shown that the results of experiments provide the best kind of support for one view or another when the issue is a factual one. When we can conduct an experiment, it doesn't do a lot of good to keep on arguing anymore. Is this going to happen or is that going to happen? Let's conduct the experiment and find out what happens. And then that will be the best basis for continuing argumentation. Note how the scientific method and the method of creative interchange have the same general characteristics. First, no one is assumed to be infallible. Everything is open to question. Secondly, there's an assumption that more information and more continuing open consideration of various viewpoints and arguments to support them can lead to the expansion of human knowledge. We are not going to be restricted to what we know now. And this will be true not just about what is true, but also about what is good and maybe even some metaphysical issues. Thirdly, even when it seems that there's a general agreement about some conclusion, further discussion and argumentation and experience can lead to further change. There's no end to the process. At no point can it be said, we now have the truth. There is always a need for further discussion or debating or experimenting. And of course, this is exactly the problem that the traditional religions have had. They have had the notion that we have the truth and it's never going to change. As previously mentioned, ethics refers to a set of ideas about what should be done, that is, about what is good or bad, right or wrong. We have also noted that scientific experimentation is limited to providing us with evidence about what is in fact true and is not able to provide us with definitive answers on ethical issues, issues about what ought to be, about what is good or bad, right or wrong. As a result of this, religious leaders are in a position to claim that humanity needs religion as the only basis for ethics and ethical behavior. Science isn't going to do it, therefore we religionists will do it. They say that people need religion to instruct them on ethical issues, and also to motivate them to act ethically rather than only for self-interest. But philosophers have shown that there are other bases for forming good opinions on ethical issues. And on the factual issue of whether religion causes people to act more ethically, this is a factual question that scientists can investigate, and scientists have shown it simply is not true. Criminals and others who engage in unethical behavior are just as likely to be religious as non-religious. There's no evidence to show that more religious people behave more ethically. Philosophers, going back to Socrates in the 4th century before the Common Era, have shown how reason can be a basis for ethical knowledge without assistance from religion. The culmination of this process was the work of the 18th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who noted that the most basic ethical principle, the golden rule, that one should act toward others as you would want them to act toward you, could be known by reason alone. Although he did this using sophisticated language like the categorical imperative and pure practical reason, but nevertheless, that was his point, that we can know that we should follow the golden rule without religion telling us that that is the case. Kant made it clear that one didn't need any kind of religious beliefs or faith in the supernatural to acquire this basic ethical knowledge. And Kant put forth this view even though he himself was sympathetic to religion. Another 18th century philosopher, the Scot David Hume, also argued that we can have good ethical insights without any religious base. In fact, he showed that religion is often used to undermine people's natural, more sensible ethical beliefs. The sensible ethical beliefs are based on empathy for others, animals as well as people. For Hume, one doesn't need religion to see that there's something very ethically wrong about torturing animals. This is not something where you need to turn to religion to find out about what's right and what's wrong. Ethical insight requires imagination and reason as well as empathy, but it certainly does not require any kind of religion or belief in the supernatural. On the issue of whether religious belief is needed to persuade people to act ethically, I believe that a common approach used in religion actually undermines ethical behavior. I refer to the notion that one should behave ethically now in order to go to heaven in the afterlife and to avoid going to hell. Or, for some religions, that one should build up good karma during this life so that things will be better in future reincarnations. These teachings undermine the very basic ethical notion that one should do what is good or right just because it is good or right, not in order to get something for oneself later on. The common religious viewpoint starts out with the understanding that there is often a conflict between what is ethically required on the one hand and what is in my immediate self-interest on the other. But then it converts all decision-making on ethical issues into acting for one's own long-term self-interest, going to heaven. It totally eliminates even the possibility of truly ethical behavior, behavior where one does what is good or right simply because it is good or right. So in summary, what can we say about science, religion, and ethics? Although the general public thinks of science in terms of the conclusions supported by the research done by scientists especially as it impacts on theoretical issues such as the theory of biological evolution or the practical area of combating deadly diseases such as cancer. What makes science science is the experimental method of testing the truth of hypotheses or theories about how the world works. Because of the way that science works, its conclusions are always tentative and subject to further study. The conclusions generally accepted today may be rejected tomorrow if new evidence turns up. Consequently, our ideas about what is true are subject to change. At the same time, it is important to realize that science is restricted to helping us know the facts, but it's not very helpful when it comes to ethical questions of good and bad, right and wrong. Religion relates to people's commitments. Traditional religions have directed those commitments to believing certain pre-scientific, pre-Enlightenment ideas about gods, about the supernatural, including the possibility of miracles, and about life after death. They have also tried to persuade people that religion is necessary as a basis for ethical behavior, and that without religion and the old beliefs, society would fall apart because of immorality. Traditional religions are presently running into trouble among educated people. I recognize that among not so well educated people, they're making great progress. But among educated people, the traditional religions are having a great difficulty because the beliefs that they have viewed as dogmatic truth inspired by God are being contradicted every day by the findings of modern science. They retain some public support only because of people's fear of the disapproval of parents, friends, and relatives. Plus, what may happen if they, quote, lose their faith in God, unquote. But religion can retain its rightful place at the center of human life if it switches away from this commitment to certain beliefs of the ancient past to a new kind of commitment to the process of creative interchange. Such a religion promotes progress, intellectual and spiritual growth, tolerance for new and different ideas, and openness to diversity. Ethics, knowing what ought to be done, does not need to rely on religion. Developing useful ideas in ethics, both ideas about what a particular individual should do and ideas about what the society as a whole should do, can best be done by the process of creative interchange, by the continuing exchange of proposals and argumentation about various ideas, with the awareness that new proposals and arguments may show up in the future. Ideas presently accepted as important for thinking about ethical issues are the primacy of the golden rule and the significant roles of empathy, imagination, and reason as we deal with ethical issues. Always ask yourself, what would an informed, impartial, non-prejudiced person do in this situation? Not what would Jesus do. What would an informed, impartial, non-prejudiced person do? In other words, the scientific method is to find out what is true. Religion, viewed as a commitment to the process of creative interchange, should be a central feature of our lives. And ethics, deliberating with others about what ought to be done and then doing it, is crucial to being a good individual, as well as a good citizen of the society generally, and a good member of the various groups to which we belong. And these are ideas promoted by this church.